the Pattern Podcast. Make left traffic, clear for the option.
Minneapolis departure, Archer 641, Charlie 2000, climbing 3000.
Line up and wait, 7 range, 4 Mike Alpha.
Mark Tower, 172, Romeo Hotel, hold short on 133, ready to take off.
Albert Delta, 3321, Mike, enemy downwind for runway 25.
I'm John.
I'm Chris.
I'm Brad.
And I'm Mark.
And we are the In the Pattern Podcast.
All right, welcome to episode 21 of the In the Pattern Podcast. Tonight is a kind of a special event for us. We got going on. We got a guest on with us tonight, and unfortunately, we're one member down. Mark, he's out right now, but maybe be able to jump on with us here shortly. But we do got Brad and John with us. How you two doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well, doing well.
It's been a little too long, huh? Life
yeah,
is,
a little bit.
Life's getting in the way, but we'll soon be getting back at this a little more regularly. Actually, we got so much stuff to go over. And our special guest tonight is Rod Rakic from Open Airplane. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on tonight.
Good. Good. Glad to have you guys. We've been kind of following a little bit of what's going on with Open Airplane through Twitter and various other media outlets, as it were. So we're kind of but a few of us haven't heard everything, so it'll be a little bit new for some of us, and some of us have a little bit better idea of what's going on, so we'll be glad to find out kind of in person what Open Airplane is all about. So without further ado, we shall get started with episode 21, and hopefully Mark can jump on here shortly. I know, Brad, you've been just going at it gangbusters to get that instrument rating knocked out. You want to catch us up to what's been going on since episode 20 and maybe not finish it out because that might even go into episode 21, but however you feel about that.
However I feel about it, I feel pretty happy about it at this point. I kind of got sick of doing the work and got my endorsement and took my check ride on Thursday and passed it, and I am finally an instrument pilot, and I'm very happy about that.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I will say the hardest part of the whole process was the IACRA form.
I was kind of surprised. I was kind of thinking this was going to take a little longer than it did, but you seemed to just go after it as as often as you could with the planes being available and the weather being whatever it needed to be for you, and you nailed it pretty quickly, it seemed to me.
Yeah, I finally kind of the stars kind of aligned and had enough time and enough access to airplanes and enough decent weather that I could go out and get enough actual to make me comfortable and just to fill out the time. I finished out with 40.0 total instrument time, whether simulated or actual or in the sim, and hit my numbers and took my check ride and somehow managed to pass it despite my best efforts to keep myself from passing. Apparently I was a little bit all over the sky.
I was it reminds me of, like, I remember some of your tweets. You're like, I'm this far into getting this rating and I'm just now learning something. I forget what it was. I was like, oh no, here comes a curveball.
Exactly. I had my endorsement and I was 4 days from the check ride and I finally figured out what alternative minimums meant. And that's actually kind of a funny story. I went to do the check ride and we're doing the oral and we're talking about alternative minimums, and the instructor had a very different, or not the instructor, the DPE had a very different idea about what alternative minimums meant. And I talked to three other CFIIs afterward and they all said, no, that's just not right. But and I couldn't find anything authoritative in the AIM or the FAR that answered the particular question that I had. But I won't bore you all with the question.
So it was your DPE who had a different idea than everybody else of what they thought it would be. Is that what you said?
Yes, yes. The DPE had a very different interpretation of what alternative minimums meant on an approach. And everybody I've talked to has had a different interpretation of what alternative minimums actually mean in terms of planning and in terms of executing the approach. And I don't know. I might just call the FISDO and see what they say and get something a little bit more authoritative. It was a lot of fun, and I'm glad it's over. And I really like the autopilot.
What'd you fly your check ride in?
I used our Archer, which has a single axis autopilot and a Garmin 430.
Right.
The non WAS 430, which introduces a whole nother pile of complexity. When you don't have a WAS certified GPS, there's a bunch of restrictions on which approaches you can use at your alternate. And like I said, I'm glad that that's over.
Yeah.
One CFII that I talked to afterwards said, listen, when it comes down to it, if you fly the approach and you land, no one's going to care.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. As long as you don't mess up and bend an airplane or whatever, you got nothing to worry about.
Yeah, I'll post it to YouTube.
Yeah, don't run out of gas. Don't end up in an NTSB report.
That's right.
You'll be just fine.
All you need.
So, yeah, I'm very happy.
Does that have just one 430 in it?
Yep, just a single 430.
And a secondary radio and nav radio?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. A really nice, I forget the model number, but it's a Garmin Navcom, and it has the really nice feature that it will automatically identify the nav aid that you tune to. So if you know, we're supposed to, when we tune to a nav aid, we're supposed to, like a VOR or an ILS, we're supposed to identify it, you know, uh-huh. Listen to it until you hear the Morse code.
Yeah.
And this thing has a CPU in it that will listen for you and say, yep, that's the Gopher VOR that you're tuned into. So all I have to do is point at it during the check ride and say, yep, I've identified my VOR and I'm good to go.
So
that was really nice.
Regarding the actual written test,
mm-hmm.
Was it basically, you know, identical to everything you've been studying?
The written is very different from what I've been studying in that the written is probably 20 years old. So there's nothing, there is the letters GPS do not exist.
Okay.
But I'll save a little bit for the next episode, and we can talk about it a little more.
Question, was there an NDB approach?
No, we didn't shoot any NDB approaches, although I probably would have used the 430 for that anyhow. But I did have an ADF in the plane, and uh-oh. I have done and partial panel NDB approaches to minimums in my practice, and actually found the airport, which according to my instructor is about as much as you can hope for.
Look, I made sure that we scheduled a aircraft with no ADF on board. Barring that, in case we had a last minute airframe switch due to maintenance or something, I decided that I needed to have some in-op stickers in my flight bag for my check ride. And as a backup to that, I carried a small ball peen hammer.
There you go. There's actually a thing in the PTS now. The PTS changed in 2009 or 2010, and there's actually a line in there that says if any navigation equipment is marked inoperative, it has to be marked that way in the aircraft log to guard against people doing exactly that.
Ball peen hammer.
Sabotage. Rules.
I don't even know where the ADF antenna on this plane is, because usually it's that long wire that leads from like the front of the cabin to the top of the tail. And there isn't one on this plane, but it has a functioning ADF.
Hmm.
I don't know. Hmm. But the instructor, the DPE did what the PTS suggests, which is have them fly approaches that they will probably fly in real life. And so we did a circle to land VOR to my home airport, and then we did a GPS and an ILS at an airport that's just 7-8 miles away. And that was, you know, it's the actual flying part of it is you know, it's three approaches and a hold and unusual attitudes and you're done. It took us about an hour and a half. And that it's, you know, it was a 3-hour oral.
That sounds like that was about like my oral for my private, and which was, I thought, a little ridiculous, but.
Yeah, we covered a lot.
How long ago did you get yours, Rod?
Oh, it's been, I guess, 2 years now. I actually went out to California and flew with a friend out of Van Nuys and flew in the system there in the Los Angeles basin.
Ooh, fun. Lots of stuff to watch out for.
Yeah, flew for about a year before completing my commercial. And next up is CFI when I can make some time.
Very good. Hey, Brad, so it was any of your time, did you ever go fly with just a safety pilot?
I did. I did 1.2 with a safety pilot just one time. And I decided that I was only about 20 hours in, and I decided that I needed more time if I was going to use a safety pilot. Uh-huh. And then by the time I was getting to the end, I was wanting to just do nothing but essentially check rides to, you know, check ride prep to get ready for it. So I ended up flying with three different CFIIs in the last 2 weeks, and we all did mock check rides of what we were pretty sure the actual ride was going to be. And it was good. It got me pretty well prepared. I was not prepared for it being a clear, blustery day with a lot of turbulence. Like I said, I'll save some of this for the next episode.
Well, so you don't want to do it on a smooth day.
I would have liked to do it in actual.
If you can do your check ride on a bumpy day, you can be, oh, sorry, you know, bumpy, you know.
Yeah, at least you got something to blame something on, huh?
Right.
Got the excuse, yes. Yes.
Right. How many hours did you have when you completed?
40.0. Or total time, are you asking?
No, for the how much training time did you have logged in training for the instrument when you took the check ride?
I had 40.0,
and that beat me.
And that included my time for my private.
Yeah, I had 44 hours of training when I took my check ride. 40.4, I think it was. And the reason for the 0.4 was I didn't want anyone deciding to start recalculating the numbers on the IACRA at the last minute just in case.
Right. Yeah. The DPE at least took the sums of my at the bottom of each page of the logbook. She trusted those. So she didn't go back and add up each individual one, but it was there. It all added up. I counted. I triple checked it before my last ride to make sure that I had every single tenth of an hour. And I verified that she would not let me take the check ride at 38.5 and then just use the time during the check ride to get up to 40. Would have been nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I guess 38.5 would have been a bummer because I only did 1.4 of actual out of the 1.5 hours total of the check ride. So then I would have come up a tenth of an hour short, and I would have busted.
Yeah, but you would have been watching the Hobbs.
Yeah.
There are no Hobbs. There's no Hobbs meter in any of our airplanes.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yep.
Everything's off the tack, huh?
Everything's off the tack.
I'd be lost.
I mean, there's not one installed on any of those planes?
There is one installed on the Warrior, but it's in op.
Yeah. Huh.
It's the best kind of Hobbs meter.
Yeah.
So, we just use tack time for everything.
I'm jealous.
And I was so happy, you know, because I'm doing my instrument rating, and when you're flying the approaches, you want to be at 90 knots, which in a Cherokee works out to about 2150 RPMs, uh-huh. You know, so you're getting the time, but you're not paying the full rate. Uh-huh. And then I went up and I took our aero, which has a constant speed prop. And so no matter what you do, it's going to be running 2400 RPM, regardless of what the manifold pressure setting is. I'm like, well, hey, wait a minute. This doesn't help. You know, here I am. I'm going 90 knots, but I'm still paying the same rate as if I was going 135. So I don't have my, I don't quite have my aero endorsement, my complex endorsement yet. I need 3 more hours.
I thought you still pull back the throttle a little bit and then, you know, adjust the RPM. And I thought you adjusted both in flight.
Well, you do, but you typically leave the, on an aero at least, you typically leave the tack set at the prop set for 2400 RPM. Hmm. And so you pull back the manifold pressure to, let's say, oh, I want to say it's about 16 inches to maintain straight and level at 90 knots at 2400 RPM. But it's still turning 2400 RPM.
Huh.
When you slow down for the descent, even in the descent in the aero, it's still going to be spinning 2400.
That's kind of like, that's economy cruise, but still turning 2400 RPM.
Right. Yes. I'm saving lots of gas and the margins are higher, but it doesn't save me a penny.
Yeah, right. Because the tack is still turning based on the 2400.
Right. So, yeah, I'm still at whatever that percentage is, 24 out of 25 or 2600 RPM.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever heard how Rod Machado explains the three controls and the power quadrant?
I don't think so.
I did, I'm blanking on it right now. It's like
so you
one
got
of
the black
noise.
Throttle. Yeah, you got the black throttle, you got the blue prop control, and then the red mixture. And he says, look, this is how you remember this. Black throttle, time. Blue prop control, noise. Red mixture, money.
Yeah, that's about it.
Which is cool because the point he was making at the time was that if you feel like you're getting behind the airplane, you know, you're blasting away at full smash toward a hold and you're not quite configured or, you know, whatever it is, you can always slow down time by just pulling back on that black throttle a little bit. And
right.
So he thought about, don't think of it as a throttle, think of it as time. And I took that as good advice.
Sounds like good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a lot.
Rod is a very smart man. Both of them.
Oh, my. Now we're sucking up.
Yeah, sure. So while we're on the subject of Rods, Mr. Rod Rakic, how about you tell us about this open airplane?
Happy to.
Just open cockpit, right?
You know, we tested a whole bunch of names. So some of you may have been exposed to some of the other domain names that we sort of tested. We had this hypothesis that we needed to come up with a name that, you know, would sort of resonate with people. So we actually, I think, ended up registering and testing like 6 different domain names. Open Cockpit was one of them. Some of them, you know what, honestly, you know, looking back at them, were probably a little more risque than they needed to be. I thought they sounded cool until a lot of really good friends, you know, made me see that maybe, you know, naming the company ReadyTail.com is not a good idea.
Yeah.
What could possibly be misinterpreted?
Right. So anyway, so 7 months ago, so we started talking about this really in sort of closed, you know, close company at Oshkosh. Mm-hmm. And have been in stealth mode for 7 months now. So the fact that I get to talk about this now is really exciting. Thank you.
That's where I remember hearing about it first. I mean, I didn't know it was
an
airplane
did.
Or whatever, but, you know, I remember some discussion about it around the area.
Yeah, it had some code names. You probably saw some hashtags on Twitter about, you know, it's the wee hours of the morning and I'm working on Project Awesome.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was Awesome for a while. And so finally we were able to start talking about it. We went to Sun and Fun last week and sort of took the wraps off this, opened the hangar door, and started talking about the project that we're now calling Open Airplane. And what that is really the idea that renting an airplane could be as easy as renting a car. I think that one of the things that people have to sort of deal with is that your pilot certificate, if you're a renter pilot, essentially turns off when you leave your home base. You know, the FAA doesn't mind the idea of you maybe living in Chicago, commercialing down to Miami, showing up at a flight school or FBO that rents airplanes and, you know, being handed the keys and the clipboard, and off you go to, you know, fly down to the Keys for brunch or something.
Seems reasonable. There's nothing, enough.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable, right? Like in a world, right? We're living in the future. I don't have a jetpack yet, but darn it, I should be able to just, you know, show up and rent the airplane without having to do this thing we call the local checkout.
Well, hey, the FAA, trust me.
Right. You know? I've proven to an FAA examiner that I know how to fly the airplane. I mean, exactly. If we had to rent cars like this, I'm willing to bet that, you know, that market would be depressed a bit, you know, and you look at what's going on in general aviation and private aviation. The trend lines are not going in the right direction. And anything we can do sort of get out of our own way and make it easier for people to do business at the airport would probably be a good thing. And that's kind of what sort of started us down this line, was the idea that, you know, if I had to show up at, say, Enterprise Rent-A-Car and take the kid from behind the counter around the pattern, you know, around the park lot three times before he lets me have the keys to the Mustang, it'd be kind of ridiculous. But isn't that sort of what we're sort of all sort of trained to sort of expect and deal with?
Exactly.
Well, Alan, by the way, you get to pay for the privilege, right? You get to pay for the kid's time and you get to pay for the airplane.
Yes.
Sure.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, how ticked off would I be when I show up at Hertz and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, you drive a Civic. I don't think you can handle this SUV over here. What?
Right, right. And so that kind of started us down the line. And quite honestly, just wanted to sort of attack at a business model level the value proposition of having a pilot certificate. So this is a really great place to talk about this, because you guys have a podcast that's essentially around pilot training. And I don't think people really understand how difficult it is to get value out of your pilot certificate, out of your credential once you get it. So you spend $10,000, maybe 6 months of your life to get a rating. And then, wait a minute, that means I can do all this cool stuff that was in the brochure, right? And
yeah.
I hear you on that one. I flew 3.2 hours last year after getting my certificate.
Ouch. Yeah, I know. And
exactly.
And we hear that a lot, right? We hear it because one of the things that ends up happening is the value proposition for having a pilot certificate, unless you're in this really sort of narrow band of, you know, you're the businessman who needs to travel and, you know, was able to go buy an aircraft and use it for business. And that's great. That's always the value sort of that, you know, people try to sell when they try to sell you into the idea of aviation. But then you actually have to keep flying to keep your skills sharp. You have to, you know, these are all sort of perishable skills that we acquire, yet you have to keep flying. But what do? As an industry, we make it as hard as possible to actually fly. So that has to end.
Thank you, insurance companies.
Well, you know, it's not as bad as you might think. So that was the first question that came up. Hey, Rod, that's a great idea, but the insurance companies will never let you get away with it. Truth be told, I think the only sort of innovation in this entire project really came from the fact that we went and talked to the insurance companies. We actually sat down. If your business card had vice president of underwriting on it at any major American aviation insurance company at Oshkosh last year, I was stalking you.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I spent most of Oshkosh. And so what I did is I went and I talked to the insurance guys. I said, guys, I have an idea. I'd like to run past you. Can I buy you a lemonade? And I sat down at a lot of picnic benches around the hangars at Oshkosh last year, talking to folks from a number of the large insurance agencies. I'll use Star Aviation Insurance as the example, because they're sort of the one that stood up first and became our launch partner in Open Airplane. And they said, you know what, you've got a plan that we can approve. In fact, it's a lot of times not the insurance company who is requiring a local checkout. It's something that just kind of happens as sort of, this is how business is done. This is the doctrine. This is how we've always done it. But if you were to go to your local rental flight school people or FBO and ask them, show me where in your policy it requires me to fly a local checkout before you'll rent me the plane. And I will make you the bet that in most cases, it doesn't exist.
So tradition got in the way.
It's tradition, right? And it's a tradition that ultimately costs the schools and the FBOs a lot of money. Because what we're doing is we're scaring away 96% of the pilots who would rather fly, but they don't want to deal with this crazy checkout requirement, you know, where it's going to cost me half a day of time and a couple of $100s of money and a whole bunch of effort just to find a rental aircraft. And so what happens is we kind of, you know, scare away 96% of our customers in order to be able to get that last 4% that are just crazy enough to actually put up with this.
Yeah, like to give an example, we go down to San Diego every year around August and hang out in my wife's aunt and uncle's houses on Coronado Island. And I would just so love to rent an airplane somewhere down there, or even better, maybe even towards L.A. and head over to what is it, the island?
Catalina.
I think that would be so cool. And then I think I'll pay a fortune just in getting checked out to where I couldn't afford to do the trip then, you know. So maybe I do that one year, and then the next year I could go get the I could do the trip. Oh no, you couldn't do that. You're out of currency with the flight school.
Right. Wait a minute. Yeah, the currency thing drives me nuts because ultimately what you're saying is, wait a minute, I flew the same make model aircraft last week, but now that because I'm in a different zip code, I have lost the ability to fly that aircraft safely. Hold on a second.
The landscape's going to screw you all up. You ain't going to figure out the airplane.
And I think that that's the thing that we, you know, again, it's a doctrine that's held the industry back, right? It's they've got it. You know, people have sort of been doing business like this for the last 50 years. I think a lot of flight schools think that they'll lose revenue if they give up on requiring currency in a particular airframe that they own versus just that airframe, right? And they'll lose revenue if they don't get paid every time you need to come in and check out. Well, they're scaring away 96% of their customers, according to the survey data that we've gathered over the last few months. So what we're trying to do with Open Airplane is sort of change the business model, make the business model for having a certificate in your pocket something that makes more sense, make the pilot certificate that's in your pocket be more valuable. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to increase your ability to access flying, not make it as hard to get in an airplane and turn dinosaurs into decibels, burn fuel, make the Hobbs meter spin if you've got one. And ultimately, I think what it'll do is it'll help us get more out of being pilots. And that means that more of us will stick to it. Fewer of us will go decide to buy a boat or a Harley. It's good for everybody.
Well, I have a quick question about that. So I learned in a Piper Archer 3, a Cherokee, right? So I go to a flight school. They don't have one of those. They've got 172s. So are you trying to make it to where it's like for like, or you're just saying you've got single engine land qualifications?
I think it's pretty clear that flying an Archer versus flying a Skyhawk is different. It's dramatically different.
I wouldn't know what to do with a fuel pump.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the wings are in a different place. You know, it's not flying the same thing. Quite honestly, flying a Skyhawk with steam gauges is pretty different if you've got a G1000 installed. So the way Open Airplane is going to tackle this is we're going to offer a standardized checkout that is make model specific.
That totally makes sense.
You know, you can come in. Let's be realistic here. We can't necessarily, you know, make it so that I can, just because my pilot certificate says single engine land, I can fly anything from a Piper Cub all the way to a Cirrus SR-22. That just doesn't make sense. Yeah. But what we can do is we can offer a way to give people the opportunity to fly the same kind of aircraft that they fly at home when they're not at home, whether that's across the country, so when you're visiting friends or family off on business, or heck, even if you're just not able to access the aircraft you normally fly and you need to go to the next airport over, right, or the FBO that's maybe on the other side of the ramp that has the exact same make model. In some cases, I've seen situations where it's the same 172 make model, and they're only a couple of few serial numbers different, right?
Wait a minute, and you're talking about common sense here.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just, but the idea that I can fly this Skyhawk, but I can't fly that Skyhawk is kind of silly. And quite honestly, the insurance companies have told us that they're okay with this idea. They're okay because there's already a case study that shows that having a standardization of the evaluation program that subjects someone to a annual standardization ride can actually lower the accident rate 60%.
I believe it.
Yep, totally makes sense.
Right. Now, we'll offer a truncated check ride when you add another airframe. So let's say you get checked out in the 172, but you fly the Diamond Star as well. Great. You go back, you do another check ride in that Diamond Star. You still show that you can, you have the systems knowledge, you have the differences training, you're able to operate that aircraft safely and competently, but it won't be as, you know, as comprehensive because a lot of the things like airspace and procedures and those are handled in the initial checkout. So you go ahead and you do an initial checkout in each airframe. And if you do that, if you step up to say, I'm willing to prove that I can fly to the standard, right, and you do this every year, you do this sort of extra thing that isn't required anywhere in the regulation, you get this extra benefit of being able to access that same make model aircraft anywhere in our network around the United States.
Sounds totally worth it.
That would have solved my 3.2-hour problem.
There you go.
See, there you go.
Because I didn't have an airplane available.
That's right. Yeah.
It's part of the problem I had.
Man, and that happened to you, John, just like shortly after you got your ticket.
Yeah, well, what happened was, is number one, I did have some money issues with being able to go up all the time, but then some student decided to ding one of the props, and the plane went down for 4 months.
Yeah.
So what am I going to do there? There's only one other plane available. I can barely get to it. And then the owner of that airplane actually pulled it because he owned the other airplane as well, and the flight school wasn't fixing it, so he pulled both airplanes, so I had nothing to fly. Yet there was, I mean, I know for a fact there was at least six other 172s of, I believe it was even the same, I think they were both SPs as well, that are available that I was in another flight school.
So, John, how much would it cost you to go get checked out to go fly at that other flight school?
Up there? I don't know. It probably would have been around $200.
Yeah. And how long would it take you?
It probably would have been one flight and some ground session.
Yeah. So half a day. It'd take you the morning.
Yeah, probably.
Right.
That's what I'm going through now. So.
And so what we want to do is we don't want to get rid of one thing. I want to be clear. We still think that you have to be able to give people a checkout.
Oh, yeah.
We still think you have to be current in order to be able to rent an airplane. Right. The difference is we don't think you have to keep doing it over and over and over again. That's like insanity.
Yeah. Oh, no. And I agree with that because like it would be nice for me in that instance to be able to fly out of the flight club that I'm joining right now, which has 172s. But then also like I so happen to be up north about an hour away with my mom or something. There's an airport right there. And I could say, hey, let's go for a flight. And they have 172s as well. I can fly the same airplane, but. You know, as long as I'm current, and I mean, to me, currency is, you know, I would keep it to 60 days at this point.
What's that?
I said I'd keep it to 60 days at this point.
Right. And that would make you a safer pilot.
Yes.
Right. So the insurance companies love that, right? They love the idea of having one standard. Right now, there is no definition of what is a checkout, right? You've got some folks who do a checkout and you know, half an hour, it's, you know, really just, you know, fly three times around the pattern, you know, shoot three landings and you're done. Others, you go out to the practice area and you fly some EPs and some slow flight, and some high air work, and then come back and do all kinds of, you know, and it's actually probably as much as you did during your private pilot check ride with the FAA. It's, you know, it gets a little ridiculous, especially if you just did, you know, something very similar, you know, at the last school you were at, you know, 2 weeks prior, right? Because no one documents what is a checkout. No one can trust anyone else's checkout. And so what happens is the industry sort of closes ranks and says, you know what? You have to do our checkout our way or you can't rent our airplanes.
Yeah.
Our planes, our rules.
Yeah, that's fine. There are going to be schools and operators that want to continue to operate that way. They just won't choose to be part of open airplane. On the other hand, we've gotten a really great response from a lot of schools around the country who have said, wow, you know, your standard is blessed by my insurance carrier. It's pretty reasonable, challenging, but not impossible. And it means that more people will fly my airplanes more often. Sweet. Sign me up.
Yeah. So what's the next step for you guys?
Well, we're hustling to build the beta. We have a prototype that we were showing folks at Sun and Fun. So we've got about 90% of our end-to-end beta code complete. And we're working to get that that part of the experience done. The other part, of course, is that we're working to recruit flight schools and FBOs that rent aircraft. So we're not going to do clubs. We're not going to do single owners. It's going to be if you've got an airplane in the United States, and not just continental United States, mind you, so Hawaii and Alaska, if you're listening, we're gonna be recruiting operators that want to add their aircraft and make their aircraft available to us via our network. And we've got three on board already. We've got aircraft available in Chicago, Detroit, and actually Raleigh, North Carolina. We're hoping to add more as quickly as we can. And that all sort of leads us to getting ready to fly sometime this year, where you can go to openairplane.com, sign up, find a local flight school that is part of our network and go through the standardization and evaluation program to get standardized with Open Airplane. And then once you've completed that, you now have access to that same make model aircraft everywhere in the country.
Cool.
Very good.
So what do you guys think the checkout is? What are you guys, you know, giving to them as saying this is our standardized checklist?
All right. So do you want to know the secret?
Yeah.
The secret is this has already been done.
Yeah, PTS.
Yep, there's the PTS. And as far as what's in the checkout, both on the ground side and the air side, let me step back, and this is really where those initial conversations with the insurance companies went. I said, look, guys, average accident rate for single-engine piston in the U.S. is about 7.11 accidents for every 100,000 hours flown, whereas there's this nationwide organization with about 8,500 pilots flying that has a standardized annual checkout. And they actually fly some pretty challenging stuff, right? They're not just, you know, flying down to grandma's house, you know, or doing $100 hamburgers, but they're actually flying some challenging stuff, but they're flying single engine piston aircraft, but they have a pretty steady accident rate that's 60% low. It's actually 2.8 accidents for every 100,000 hours flown compared to 7.11.
Wow.
And that's the Civil Air Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
We basically said, well, if CAP can do it, then the rest of us could too. So what we want to do is we want to offer up basically what is the same as the Civil Air Patrol Form 5 check ride to all the other pilots out there who want to step up and fly to the standard.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, and they got a great reputation, so why not use that model?
Yeah.
Well, in fact, we're going to actually use the CAP Form 5 as our model. We've actually gotten approval from the insurance carriers to grandfather CAP pilots into open airplane without a checkout because they've already done the checkout.
Uh-huh. In the type of airplane that they were using for CAP.
Right, right. Obviously. So there will be 8,500 pilots who are flying, for the most part, Cessna 172s, Cessna 182s. I have yet to find an operator that has GA air vans available for rent, but if they're out there, please call me because those pilots are already checked out. They have already gone through a very comprehensive standardization program. Let's get them flying. Let's get them you know, coming to you with their wallets open, ready to do business.
Yeah.
I think what's going to happen here is that these FBOs or whoever is renting these airplanes using the current model, after Open Airplane gets out there for a little bit, they're going to start noticing less and less people renting their airplanes, and it's going to have them, you know, questioning what's going on here. Is the market in another downturn? What, did I miss something? And they'll, you know, they'll get wise to the fact that they need to get on board.
Well, we just want to make the operators who are great operators. That's the number one thing. We're looking for some great operators out there, and we want to give them an opportunity to bring in more revenue, do more business. Ultimately, it's the math is pretty simple. Every aircraft owner has, you know, spreadsheets of how many hours operated versus how many, you know, hours in maintenance and cost of ownership and all that, you know, jazz. Ultimately, the more an airplane flies, the more profitable it is. If you've got an airplane that isn't flying very much, you need to either get more people to fly the airplane or get rid of the airplane. Unfortunately, it's the latter that's been happening more and more often.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we're gonna do our darndest sort of to fix sort of this value proposition problem that, you know, private aviation has, right? Right now, part of the value proposition of, you know, being a pilot and staying a pilot is that you're a little sick in the head. And you know, and that's not a good way to sort of, you know, grow an ecosystem and grow a market and an economy. So how about let's make the value proposition that you can actually use the credential that you've invested so much time and money to get. And the more you use it, the safer you become. Hence, the more, you know, value you can, you know, ascribe to it. And you know, and it becomes this kind of flywheel, virtuous cycle that the more people fly, the cheaper it gets, the more cheaper it gets, the more people fly.
Very good. While we're on the subject of that, I did recently get checked out in a different airplane. And so since it kind of goes along with this subject, I'll just tell you about it real quick. So as you know, I flew this Piper Archer 3 that I got all my training done in, and that's what I was being, that's what I've been renting so far. But it was down for its 100-hour inspection for, I don't know, 6 or 7, 8 weeks, almost 2 months, and it was just to the fact that the mechanic just didn't have time for it at the time. They just couldn't get it in, I guess. And I don't know why they didn't, you know, have it go over to someone else, because basically that's just a whole lot of lost revenue for them. So anyways, my flight instructor, you know, she couldn't use it either. So anyways, I kind of got tired of it, and I said, I got to get me a backup plan. So I went over to Glendale Airport, which is no further away than Deer Valley is from me, and they're almost identical distances away, so that's kind of nice to have. A friend of mine who I'd met on Twitter, in fact, said that he went over there and got checked out in it, and I asked him how it was. He goes, oh, it's pretty easy. You know, it's real simple. You know, you just fill out the form, you know, kind of like your pre-solo form that you fill out. You know, here's the airplane, here's the POH, you know, find the correct answers. So you have kind of a basic idea of your V speeds and whatnot, and then go get your check ride. So I did that, and I went up, and these guys are just really cool, nice, and laid back, and they're like, hey, you know, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. And so we just went up, and kind of like you mentioned before, Rod, I did three laps around the patch and a full stop landing, so two stop and goes, or two touch and goes and a full stop. And that was my day for getting checked out in a 172 SP, and it was 0.6 of an hour on the Hobbs meter.
And that was it?
That was it.
No stalls, no steep turns, nothing?
Nothing. I was totally expecting to go through that, but not at all. So, that's one of the good stories that you hear about doing this, but I think more often than not, what John is saying is probably more true. Let's go out to the practice area and go through all the basic, you know, let's go do the steep turns, let's go do some S turns, let's go do some stalls, you know, engine out procedures, all that stuff. and which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but it was nice to knock it out fairly quickly. And then I followed up by 2 weeks later renting one of the other planes that they have there. They have three 172s. Two of them are SPs, and one's a little older, maybe like an F model or something. So they have two that are fuel injected, and one that's carbureted. So in order to go in the older one that's carbureted, he does want me to get checked out in it. So I guess we can go through here. Here's how to use the carb heat. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's a lot different because I'm about to get checked out in a carb heat one. But my checkout that I'm about to do hopefully soon. I'm waiting to get a call from them, but I'm going to have to go do essentially a mock check ride, which I am perfectly expecting and I was wanting, because it's been a couple months and I realized that if I'm out of currency, I really want to go up and I really want to do stalls again. I want to do steep turns again, and I want to make sure that I'm actually still good to fly. So if I get into trouble, I know that I can get myself out of it.
Exactly.
And then I won't get myself in trouble to begin with. So.
Yeah, that's one reason why when we designed the interface for Open Airplane, where, you know, you're looking at a map, all the aircraft, and then you select which aircraft you want to fly, and you book you make a request to book the aircraft right there online. And so you pick the day you want to fly, you pick the time you want to start, you want to pick the time you want to bring the airplane back. But then we've got a couple of sliders there, one for like, do I want to keep the airplane overnight, you know, make that easy. But there's a slider that makes it just the swipe of your thumb, if you're using, say, a smartphone, will let you book the instructor. Because just because you can fly without an instructor doesn't mean you want to fly. And so yeah, we're gonna make it very easy to just, you know, make that part of the transaction if you choose.
That's awesome.
Very good.
So
yeah,
you guys are handling the booking?
We're handling the booking.
Online
scheduling.
Absolutely.
So what we're doing is, you know, one of the challenges we've got is try going to, you know, pick a random town and start a stopwatch and try to figure out how long it'll take you to actually have successfully booked a rental aircraft. You know, between the Googling and the scooting around and looking at these, you know, websites, you know, and so, sometimes, quite honestly, the data on the website isn't available, right? You know, you go to book an airplane, yeah, because you look at their webpage, and then you call them probably the next morning, right? Because, you know, it's late at night when you're doing this. And then when you call them on the phone to book the aircraft, they tell you, oh, yeah, that airplane, you know, got sold 2 months ago. You know, we can't even rent you that airplane. So, you know, it's really hard, you know, and over 20% of the folks in our survey said the reason they don't rent away from home is just that it's too hard to find the airplane. It's just, you know, I don't want to spend 45 minutes, you know, surfing the internet and talking on the phone just to be able to, you know, rent an airplane.
Yeah.
So they say, not worth it. I'll go do something else. So we're going to do that all that for you. There's going to be a little map. You just tell us. The interface actually starts by simply asking the question, where do you want to fly?
That's awesome.
And by answering that question, we graphically depict where the aircraft are available. You get to see details on what the aircraft are equipped with, what kind of condition they are. Actually see ratings, reviews by the folks who have flown them previously. Really just give you an opportunity to know what to expect when you show up on the ramp.
Mm-hmm.
And then simply make a booking request there. So you don't actually have to get on the phone and talk to someone. There's a button that lets you dial up the operator, you know, if you want, but in a lot of cases, you know, who wants to have to try to connect with another person synchronously? You know, if you can do it asynchronously, if you can just, you know, it's 2 a.m. and you're doing your trip planning, and one of the things along with booking your hotel online, booking your renter car online, booking your tickets to the show online, I also want to, you know, book access to an airplane online, and no one's really made that available on a broad basis before. So we're gonna solve the booking problem.
So how does that work with the different systems that each of the flight schools use? Because, you know, every flight school does a different way of scheduling. So how do you kind of bridge that? Like,
we actually looked at that, and one of the things we did is we started with the idea that we're going to connect to everybody's scheduling system. And for those that don't have a scheduling system, we would offer them one. Then we decided that it would just be simpler for your request to go to the flight school and they figure it out.
Okay.
You know, a lot of these schools, I mean, their scheduling system is there's a calendar, you know, big paper calendar on the glass top counter at the, you know, at the front of the school.
Old school. I used to fly. I was like that.
Yeah, you know, and you call the guy up and you're like, hey, I was wondering if you have an airplane available on Saturday at noon. I'll be back by 6. Okay, hold on. Let me go look at the schedule. And he kind of shuffles over and, you know, flips to the right page. And then it's available. And he draws a line. He writes your phone number on the line. It's really quaint. And plenty of schools operate that way. And as far as I'm concerned, they can continue to operate that way. Later on in our product development roadmap with Open Airplane, we definitely want to sort of start connecting to scheduling systems and all that kind of stuff. But for now, if I can just make the request, and if it happens to be that happy accident that my request matches with their schedule and they can grant me the request and we never actually have to talk on the phone, and all I do is press a big green button on my phone and all the operator has to do is press a big green button on his phone or on his web browser, and boom, you're done. Fantastic.
Yeah, he just gives you the approval and you get notified that it's available. It's yours.
Right. So we're going to keep it very simple just to get this thing rolling, and we'll get fancy as we go along.
Cool.
I had a question about I'm in a flying club, and we've got 70 or so people in it, including 4 or 5 CFIs. Would that, if the CFIs got checked out and were able to administer the check ride to our members, would our members be able to participate in something like Open Airplane?
To start with, the only folks who will be standardized to give our check ride will be the operators who are part of our network.
Got it.
Right? So you have to be a rental operator that has an aircraft, you know, that is available for rent. It's got to be insured. It's got to be insured on what's called an open pilot warranty, which means that you don't have to be named insured to fly that airplane. Most clubs, not all, but most clubs have the names of everybody who's, you know, in the club on the insurance.
Correct.
And that model sort of breaks if, you know, you're just talking about renting the airplane. There's plenty of clubs that will, you know, sell you a 2-week membership to our club so you can come fly the airplane. Well, I don't know. It's kind of silly, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to start with flight schools that have a, you know, shingle waving in the wind, you know, that says rent me, you know, and because there's plenty of those out there. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to keep it fair by only allowing folks who have an aircraft for rent to standardizing people to fly and rent them. So it's kind of mutually assured destruction, right? The flight school in Chicago is checking out a pilot to fly at another flight school in Miami. But the flight school in Miami is checking out a pilot who might be flying in Chicago. And by balancing that equation, we can keep it fair for everybody.
Got it. And the other question I had were if there were any limitations that were going to go on there. Is this day VFR? Is this VFR day and night? Is this IFR? I don't know the extent of what a Form 5 covers.
Sure. Well, basically, the limitations are going to be that, one, you're going to be starting out as a pilot. You're going to be either a light sport or a private pilot or better. So we're not going to be offering rentals to students with Open Airplane to begin with. You've got to have a current medical. You have to be current to fly as pilot in command. You can do a checkout if you haven't flown in a while, but you won't be able to rent via the platform unless you've got 90-day currency in your logbook somehow. Doesn't have to be at that particular school. So I could have flown last week in Chicago. I haven't been to Miami in a couple of years, but darn it, I just flew last week in Chicago. So that means when I get to Miami, I can fly that airplane, right? So as long as I've got that 90-day pilot in command currency, I'll be able to rent in our network. We are going to have some limitations. There are edge cases. Catalina Island, if you've not sort of gotten the special differences and specific sort of tribal knowledge about what it takes to operate safely in a Catalina Island, it's probably an edge case, and we're going to look at that. A better sort of general edge case is mountain flying, right? I fly in Chicago. We don't have mountains. So, we're going to limit people to only operating and out of airports below 8,500 MSL to start with. And at some point, we'll try to add a mountain flying clinic or something. So there's definitely going to be limitations. Most of the limitations will be, generic. There will be some limitations that would be ascribed by the operator's insurance carrier. So some insurance carriers are like, hey, if you're legal to do it, go for it. If other insurance carriers are saying, we're not comfortable with the risk of, say, IFR flight, right? We're going to stick to VFR. That'll be up to that school or FBO's insurance carrier. And so we're going to be like Switzerland when it comes to insurance. We're going to be flexible enough to let every insurance carrier and every school decide what they need to do to be able to manage their risk appropriately for their business. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think it does. It gives me a good overview, and I think it'll be pretty clear to everybody who's a listener too. I think it's a good way to do it. I think it's a reasonable balance that you're striking. There's a lot of benefit to it. I think you'll get a lot of interest in the program.
Well, thanks. The last thing I forgot to mention is that we are going to require that renter pilots carry a minimal amount of renter's insurance. I think a lot of people don't do that.
That was going to be my next question.
I'm about to go do that.
Good job there, you go. So the theory here is that what we want to do in every case, both for the operators and the pilots, we want to be incentivizing both parties to be doing their best, right? And doing the right thing. And we know that one of the things that just sort of, it's like eating your vitamins, right? Is you should carry some sort of renter's insurance. Of course, we were freaked out when we first started talking to the insurance carriers because we thought, well, they'll approve our plan here, but they're going to make, you know, the level of insurance that must be carried so high that, you know, no one will be able to afford to do it. Well, Star Aviation has a package for renters that costs around $150 a year.
It's cheap.
Yeah.
I think that's about what AOPA quotes too.
It's a competitive market, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what we're doing is we're establishing that you should have renter's insurance. How much renter's insurance you carry, the minimums are pretty minimum, right? You should always carry as much insurance as you need to be able to sleep at night. But what Open Airplane is doing is incentivizing that good behavior on the part of the pilot for all parts of the transaction. Should the pilot have insurance? Yes, great. We're going to require that. Should the pilot make sure that they get the airplane back on time? Great. We're going to incentivize that. Should the pilot not bald spot a tire? We're going to incentivize that they don't do that. Should the pilot not leave FOD on the cockpit? Yeah, you're right. We're going to ensure that our rental operators get the best sort of renters they've ever had through our program. Vice versa, we're going to make sure that the operators who are renting to the pilots to participate in Open Airplane are getting the best sort of, you know, experience possible too.
The club I'm about to join just had a huge issue with bald tires. So I find that hilarious.
So what are they going to do to the guy that balded the tires?
I don't think that, because it was a bunch of people. They've gone through something like in the past, I want to say 6 months, something like 8 to 20 tires from what I gathered.
On one plane?
No, on multiple planes, but throughout the club, like a ton of tires in a ridiculously short amount of time.
Was it winter?
Yeah, but we haven't gotten any snow.
Yeah. Good point.
So
around here you go through tires because it's winter, there's snow on the runway, you land, you apply the brakes, and then you go from the snow and ice covered portion of the runway to the dry portion.
No, it's literally because people want to make the midfield cutoff. So they slam on the brakes. So
yeah. The problem has been that up until this point, the operators haven't had much they can do to you, right?
Exactly.
They can wag their finger. If they can absolutely prove that, you know, you've you're the guy that put the bald spot on the tire. Look, there's cord showing. You know, they can charge you for some new tires or something like that. But ultimately, you can kind of shrug and say, it's a rental.
Exactly.
And we're not satisfied with that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to skip ahead here and point out that when you rent with Open Airplane, when you bring the airplane back to the operator, two things are going to happen. One is you're going to input your hobs or your time, press a big green button, and your billing is done.
Awesome.
No more awkward, you know, swiping of credit cards and, you know, totaling up what's on account. You put in your time that you're billing for the airplane. You hand in the keys and the clipboard and you walk out the door.
That's awesome.
That solves sort of that part of the hassle.
Yeah. Right?
The other thing is, as soon as you've done that, the operator will then rate you as a renter.
I was hoping you were about to say that.
Really? That's cool. I think a lot of people get freaked out about the idea of getting a rating for how they fly.
No, that was going to be my next question when you were bringing up the whole, you know, thing about pilots is do we get rated too? Because I think that's genius.
We want to rate both. We want to use ratings and reviews on both the part of the operators and the pilots to incentivize good behavior. The pilot who comes back, brings the airplane in a flyable condition, make sure that it's got oil, that it's been, you know, the fuel has been, you know, loaded correctly, that the cockpit has been cleaned up, that the maybe even took a little bit of water and got the windscreen in good shape, got the bugs off of that while they were, you know, easy to get off, you know, and basically, you know, takes care of the rental aircraft as it should be, is probably going to get a pretty good review. The guy who brings back the airplane 3 hours late, bald spots the tire, and leaves spot in the cockpit is not going to get a very good review. So what then happens is both of those folks make requests of the network to rent the next airplane. Guess who gets to rent the airplane and guess who's going to kind of get squinted at?
Yeah.
So what we can hopefully do is get, you know, most of the pilots out there are flying they're very conscientious renters, right? They treat the rental airplane like it was their own. Then you got that small sort of component of the population that's like, it's a rental. What we want to do is we want to help the pilots all up their game.
I mean, that does a number of things because, number one, it makes the planes better for everyone who's renting because they're not being beat to crap. And then it also, honestly, was going to make all of us better pilots because we're going to be a lot more conscientious about what we're doing. I mean, that's so many gains of, I guess, awesome at that point.
Yeah.
You know?
We hope so. We hope so. The other thing is that when you're done flying, you'll also then be able to rate the aircraft at the tail number level.
So you can rate the flight school, the pilot, and the aircraft.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good.
That's it. That's all. It's easy, really.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Well, much success to that, Rod. It sounds like a fantastic program. I don't really see how it could fail. It just sounds like it makes so much common sense that, you know, you shouldn't have a problem getting people to jump on board.
And if he's got FBOs and insurance companies on board, you know, what more do you need?
We need pilots. We just blew through, actually, this morning, our first 1,000 signups at openairplane.com.
Awesome.
And so hopefully anyone else who's listening would like to get updates as we get closer to launching the service can go to openairplane.com and just give us your email address and we'll keep, you know, sending the occasional update until we're ready to sign you up and get you flying.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I got some kind of like karma or something from that the other day.
Love it.
I forget what you guys actually called it. Was it karma?
Clout.
Is that what it was? Sorry, I'm on Reddit too much nowadays.
If you, so you can also follow us on Twitter and you can also like us on Facebook. So you can search Open Airplane on Facebook or search Open Airplane on Twitter. Obviously that helps us sort of spread the word about what we're doing. We really appreciate that. Just over 200 people are following us on Twitter now. getting close to 100 people following us on Facebook. That's going to be the way we sort of keep people up to date on the program, as well as everyone who's sort of signing up will get to sign up for free, so that all the folks that get an early sign up won't be charged a membership fee. And you're also going to be invited to actually help us design the service, right? So when we come up with parts of the experience, we're going to be reaching out to all the folks who have signed up and offering them an opportunity to sort of chime in and tell us what they like and what they don't like. So we're really doing this together with everyone who's sort of joining the community.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
I'm signed up.
I'm checking.
Awesome.
I signed up as soon as I heard.
I think I'm already signed up as well. I'm going to double check.
I also asked David Allen right away if it was the same thing that I had heard in Oshkosh, and he was like, yep. And I was like, awesome. I was so excited to hear that that was getting announced.
Well, at Oshkosh, it was just an idea, right? It was this kooky idea of how can we sort of make flying better. Then, since we had some traction with the industry, where we kept talking to the insurance guys, and the insurance guy goes, yeah, that makes sense. We can get behind that, right? And it was all very just, talking to industry folks and sort of proposing something and seeing what would work and what wouldn't. And it just started sort of snowballing, right? So then we sort of went quiet about it for 7 months and really just kind of stuck to our knitting. The co-founder of Open Airplane is Adam Fast. You guys know him from projects like, social media, everything, and Osh Planner and all the other things that he sort of does around aviation, right? So he built a wicked fast application to power Open Airplane.
That runs on Python.
Yes.
I knew it.
Python on the back end. You bet. You know Adam. You know that he's an expert in Python. So, yeah. He for those of you with the nerd bent, he's written Open Airplane to run completely in memory. We won't write to disk during a user session. It'll That's be insane. That fast. I think he was just showing off.
Honestly, because I use the same framework that he does, and I wow.
Yeah, he's that good. So we're really lucky to have him on board.
That's awesome.
And we've got some other folks. If you poke around the internet, you'll find out that David Allen's going to be helping us out with community development, sort of, recruiting, onboarding, and supporting pilots. He's not only super excited about aviation, but he's also a customer support professional, and he knows how to do that. So we're going to have really fantastic sort of concierge level support for our pilots. And then Jason Hoffman, who some of you met at Sun and Fun, is going to be onboarding the schools and FBOs in our network.
This would have completely solved my issues in the past year.
Well, we think that you're one example, and there are probably a lot more examples like you out there, and those are the folks we want to serve.
Yeah, I mean, I can't be the only one who got my private and then just like had a hard time flying after that. So
yeah, we'll make a lot of people's lives easier when it comes to finding a plane, for sure.
Get you flying.
One of the other things I wanted to mention when I went over there and got checked out in that 172. Talking about keeping the plane overnight. They're like, oh yeah, we don't have any minimum hours. If you want to keep the plane overnight, that's cool. You're still just going to pay for Hobbs time. I was like, get out of here.
I'm jealous.
That's sweet.
Well, it's nice because I would love to go and fly up to Sedona and stay at, they have a little a real nice hotel resort thing that's actually on the Mesa, where you land up there right next to the airport, so you can walk right to it from your airplane.
How much flying would that be? What would be your flight time?
It's a 40 to 45 minute flight.
How long's the drive?
Hour and a half.
Okay.
So, it'd be fun to do the flight, but, nine times out of 10, you go rent an airplane and you keep it overnight. They want 3 hours on the Hobbs meter.
And at that point, it doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely.
Because I'm looking at that now and I'm like, well, I'd like to fly to Cambridge, Maryland, CGS, if you care. But, I want to fly there, but it's a 25-minute flight. Now, granted, it is a two-hour drive, but if I want to keep it overnight, I'm not making up the time for the 3 hours. Yet, if I flew to Providence, Rhode Island, it would actually make sense for me to do it.
Yeah.
That's my issue that I'm kind of debating with now is that minimum time thing, which I understand, but it doesn't make sense.
It depends on the market, right?
Yeah.
Some operators, need to have that minimum time, because otherwise they're going to lose money in the transaction, because now the aircraft isn't available to someone else, right?
Exactly.
And some operators don't. But what we're going to do is we're going to kind of create that marketplace where you now have access to good information about the airframes, you know, pricing of the airframes, the policies that govern how you'll use the airframes, and we're going to create this marketplace where suddenly you can make good decisions. Maybe the more expensive airframe suits you better. Maybe you want an airframe that's a little bit shinier because you've got someone you need to impress on board. Whereas, you know, other days you're like, look, I just want to go and enjoy the nice weather and get some landings in. So why don't I just go ahead and take the somewhat disheveled but mechanically sound trainer that might not be as shiny, right? Like, and so, you know, we just don't want people to be surprised with what they get when they show up on the ramp. And that's why we're sort of building this sort of reputation system. And
yeah, the rating system totally solves that, doesn't it?
We hope so. We hope so. I mean, it's done wonders for the restaurant business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everything. Right. I mean, you know, you want to download an app for your iPhone or your Android device. You know, I base my decision on a lot of my decision on, you know, that rating. Is it worth your time?
Hell, I'm at Target and I will just scan something into Amazon on my phone to see what the ratings are for it.
Yeah.
Yep. You know,
I bought my TV online. You know, I took like weeks before I made that decision because I was spending exactly. day in, day out, you know, checking ratings on these things, and not just from one source, but multiple. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
you just gave me a really good idea, but I can't tell you about it until we do it. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
We won't you guys rock.
Trademarking it or anything.
All right. That thanks, sounds guys.
Awesome. That sounds awesome.
Really appreciate the opportunity. To come
yeah.
Talk
thanks
to you
for coming
it.
On. I'm excited to hear about this.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll get more guys and gals that are in training that are, you know, working on their flight training. Now, and this is one more reason to get excited about flying, to complete the training, get out there and be flying and sort of enjoy the privilege.
Yeah, it's a win-win. That's a winner, right? Well, we are already right about an hour long. We still have tons of material to cover, which we can easily do in episode 22.
We have a lot to talk about in 22, and hopefully by then we'll have been flying. So first time since August, which would be awesome.
Wow. And hopefully Mark can join us too. So.
Yeah. So I guess before we go ahead and leave, we'll get Rod one more time. If you could just let us know where we can find everything about Open Airplane. And I guess my transponder too.
Oh, yeah, that. Right, right. you know, my transponder's not going anywhere. People still find value in that. People still connect with each other, find each other that way. So
yeah.
So that project's not going anywhere. But Open Airplane, the easiest place to find information about right now is our launch page, which you can find at openairplane.com. If you happen to be on the Facebook, you can search Open Airplane, and you can also find us on Twitter at Open Airplane. If anyone has any questions for me, hey, easy. We didn't make it a secret code. It's rod@openairplane.com. That's my email address. You can drop me a line. Love to hear from you, especially if you're flight school and you have an aircraft for rent.
There's a couple in my area that you need to talk to.
Great. Send them my way. Actually, I will send them Jason's way. But but yeah, we're definitely interested in finding the best operators out there and offering them a chance to be first in the network.
Very good.
Actually, that brings up an interesting point with the SFRA around DC.
Yeah, I count that as the edge case that we talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, honestly,
we're looking at that.
Honestly, it's realistically a simple. You have the certificate thing from the FAA that says you took the course online, which is a half hour course. It's entirely radio communication. Just you call up a Tonga approach, and it's just like getting flight following, except you just have to do it. It's the only difference.
Sure.
So, but yeah, I just thought about that because I'm inside that, but the flight school I'm talking about is actually outside of it. So
that probably makes it easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to definitely spend a lot of time when we onboard flight schools to understand their local procedure, sort of that tribal knowledge that, you know, sort of fills the gap. Ultimately, what we want to do with Open Airplane is give folks who rent via that platform sort of the confidence to fly like a local.
Yeah.
And so we're going to offer, just like we're offering all this very detailed information about the airplane that you might be renting, we're going to, at the operator level, we'll offer sort of tribal knowledge and local procedures in a standardized presentation to let pilots understand sort of what's special about operating at a particular airport. All those things that, you know, all those little gotchas that, you know, sort of undocumented. The theory behind this, when we first started talking to people about this, and they said, well, you know, there's something to be learned when you do a local checkout. I said, you're right, absolutely. And the typical, let's say the typical checkout is 45 minutes. One of the theories we're going to be testing by starting this business is that, and that's typical 45-minute checkout, there's probably 3 minutes of knowledge transfer.
Yeah.
Right? There's that golden little nugget that the guy will kind of mention while you're flying around and doing your checkout that makes, you know, approaching an airport or operating with a particular airspace or, you know, whatever, those pro tricks.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just don't think you need to burn 45 minutes of avgas to get those.
No. I mean, it should be three minutes on the internet.
Right. We have this on the internet, right? So what we're going to do is we're gonna collect those for you and make those easy to get to.
That's awesome. Because I know of three airports around here that would benefit from having just, you know, that little snippet of information that's like, okay, well, don't fly over that hospital and, you know, park here because of some reason type of thing.
Here's where the cheap gas is.
Exactly. Things like
that. Yeah, so we're working on that part of the platform right now.
Cool.
Awesome. That's good to know. Cool.
Guys, thanks again so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks so much, Rod.
Yeah, out there.
Thanks for coming on, Rod.
I'm sure we'll see you at Oshkosh.
Oh, we'll be there. You bet.
Yeah.
You're gonna be at the gathering of podcasters where we take over a street, right?
Oh, are you kidding? I love the fact that when we zoom in on sort of the, you know, sort of the Firebase My Transponder area from last year, you know, that I can see my Jeep on Google Earth. It's really cool.
Isn't that cool? I'm bringing my quadricopter next year too.
Oh, cool. With the camera on it.
Yeah. I'm seriously, we need to be like the South Africans up the street and have a podcaster lane named after that street. I mean, social media, I don't know, something. It needs to be...
Well,
we need to take it over.
Stay tuned. We'll see what my transponder comes up with this next year.
Oh, okay. I'll be waiting because I'm ready to put my money down for the extra week to get the bigger place.
Fabulous. All right, guys, I got to roll.
Cool, man. All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rod.
All right. So we are going to finish up with our where you can find us.
Yeah. So, Chris, where can we find you?
Yes, you can find me on my transponder and Twitter at CHOLUBAZ. That's CHOLUBAZ. And at Chris at InThePatternPodcast.com. John, how about you?
Well, you can find me at John at InThePatternPodcast.com, on Twitter as Pilot Conway. I'm on my transponder as Pilot Conway, and I'm also on Google Plus as John L. Conway IV.
And Brad?
You can reach me at Brad at InThePatternPodcast.com, on Twitter at Brad Kane, my transponder as Kane, and Google Plus as Brad Kane. And Kane, of course, is spelled Kilo Oscar Echo Hotel November.
You can reach us all at podcast at InThePatternPodcast.com, on our website at www.InThePatternPodcast.com. We're also on Twitter and Google Plus as InThePattern. And we have a my transponder page at InThePatternPodcast. Finally, you can call us and leave a voicemail at 707-PCAST-01. That's 707-PAPA-CHARLIE-ALPHA-SIERRA-TANGO-01. We look forward to hearing from you. And I guess this about wraps up episode 21 of the InThePattern Podcast. We'd like to thank you all for listening. Remember, make left traffic. You're clear for the option.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head.com.
The members of the In the Pattern podcast are participating as private individuals. Their comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the various organizations they work with, the instructors they learn from, or the flight schools they attend. Remember, these guys are student pilots, so anything you hear on this podcast that sounds like advice on an aircraft operation is obviously from the perspective of student pilot. You should always consider your own situation, consult your instructor, remember your training, and fly the airplane. Cleared for the option.